Hello there and welcome into another edition of The Intersection with conversation about a variety of topics including news, information, and lifestyles approached from a Christian worldview perspective. This podcast is being released on Mother's Day weekend and I wanted to open up with two moms who bring some unique stories. First up, it's former Amazing Race contestant and former Miss South Carolina Kelly McCorkle Parkinson, who had her heart open to adopting a child from India, a place where she had competed in the TV show but had never wanted to go back. Then it's Tricia Seaman, an oncology nurse who had a divine appointment with a dying patient, a single mother who wished for Tricia to adopt her 8-year-old son. Find out more ahead. You'll also be hearing from former astronaut, retired Air Force Colonel James Dutton, who has joined the board of Faith Comes By Hearing, which is exploring new technology to more effectively reach people throughout the world with God's Word. And you'll meet a man who left his home and business in Middle Tennessee and moved his family in order to minister to the destitute in South Africa through the Ministry of Living Hope, utilizing a very creative way to effectively feed people there. And on this edition of The Intersection, it's some analysis from a Christian worldview perspective by college professor and film critic Alyssa Wilkinson of the King's College and Christianity Today, who comments on the theme of the apocalypse in popular entertainment. Plus, former pastor Sean Lovejoy of the organization CourageToLead.com spent some time with me recently to discuss the importance of vision and approaching God's vision for a church or organization with tenacity. Finally, some commentary from Travis Weber of the Family Research Council about a case involving a military member who had posted Bible verses in her workspace and was ordered to remove them. She refused, was court-martialed, and discharged from the military. Her case is on appeal. This is The Intersection, a production of The Meeting House. I'm Bob Crittenden. Kelly McCorkle Parkinson is a mom, pastor's wife, former Miss America contestant, and participant in the Amazing Race television show. God placed a desire on her heart to adopt a child, and in her book, He Knows Her Name, An Amazing Pursuit to Adopt from India, she elaborates on her journey. From a recent conversation, this is Kelly McCorkle Parkinson.
Well, I love to tell people, as the saying goes, never say never, because as I returned from competing on The Amazing Race and said that I would never go back to the country of India, just a few weeks later, maybe a few months later, I received a phone call from a professor of mine at North Greenville University, which is where I went to school, and he asked if I wanted to join he and some other students from North Greenville to return to India to go on a mission trip. And shortly after we filmed The Amazing Race, and in between that time, a horrific tsunami had hit India, and so the focus of the trip was going to be going back and doing some work with the tsunami survivors and just really also documenting what Christians had done in India since the tsunami hit, and to come back and report here to the States. And I have to tell you, my heart was just... It was just really hesitating when he asked me, because I just remembered all those feelings and really just the culture shock that I had experienced when I was in India during The Amazing Race. And there was just a big part of me that wanted to say no. But I told Dr. Hagen, which was my professor, that I would pray about it. And just the Lord just kept chipping away at my heart. And eventually I called him back and said, yes, I would go.
Wow. And while you were there, God, or at some point, I guess I should say, God really touched your heart. You went to India, and you also developed a desire to adopt a child. Tell me the process that God took you through in doing that.
Well, this trip, this mission trip, was incredible. First off, I don't know if just going to this country with a different lens through my eyes, you know, whereas I went the first time, I was in a competition and the focus was about winning. It was more on me. But this time I went just with the focus to serve and just with the mission part. And I just fell in love with that country. I just saw people that were resilient and people that really just needed the hope of Jesus. And I just... again, just fell in love with that country. And because we were doing tsunami work, there were obviously a lot of orphans just due to losing their parents in the storm. And so we did a lot of work in orphanages. And we spent a lot of time all across the coastline of India but it was one of the last places that we went. We were in Chennai, and we were in a home, and I just remember it was just the Lord making it very clear to me that one day I was going to adopt a little girl from India. And I laugh about that because I was single at the time. Well, I was dating someone, but I was single. And I remember telling the Lord, well, you got to take care of the husband part first. And I actually returned from that trip, and my husband proposed to me. So God was already taking care of it. But that's where he laid the foundation there just for the desire to adopt a little girl from India.
Kelly McCorkle Parkinson here on The Intersection. You can find out more by visiting the website kellyparkison.com. Well, this is The Intersection with Tricia Seaman. She's an oncology nurse who wrote a book called God Gave Me You, A True Story of Love, Loss, and a Heaven-Sent Miracle. In our recent conversation, she shared some of the story about her relationship with a dying cancer patient who asked Tricia to adopt her 8-year-old son. From that conversation, this is Tricia Seaman.
Well, after about 3 weeks in the hospital, she was preparing to go home. And that particular day, she had received the news from her doctors that her cancer had indeed spread. It was terminal. And I walked into the room to say goodbye to her, and she told me the news that about her cancer, and then she followed that with asking, when I die, will you and your husband raise my son?
Mm. So how did you respond to that? What are some of the thoughts that you had?
Oh, my. Well, it was really complete shock initially. I didn't know how to respond because certainly I was there as a professional, and I was trying to, you know, give comfort to her. It was a terrible thing that she had just heard. And, you know, honestly, the first thing I thought was that, you know, she's just absolutely can't even be thinking straight after hearing this. And I really just encouraged her, you know, to take some time with thinking through this, and wanted to be sure she was making an absolute, you know, best decision in that case. So, you know, I didn't say yes or no. I just asked her to please take some more time with it.
So what was going through your mind, and also as you presented this option, say, to your husband and your family, what are some of the thoughts that you had?
Well, I certainly, of course, you know, spoke with my husband as soon as I was out of work that day. Before I even, you know, put the keys in the ignition of the car, I dialed him and said, hey, you're just never going to believe what happened to me today. You know, my husband is a very calm person, and that's a good thing. And he said, you know, Tricia, he said, I really believe that, you know, God works in very amazing ways, and this could quite possibly be what we've been praying for, you know, as far as adding a child to our family. However, you know, he said, I think we just need to, you know, take some time with it, give it some prayer. And first and foremost, his concern for her was that she had everything she needed, just basic things, food and, you know, ability to get her medicines and transportation to appointments and things like that, you know. And that was Dan's first thought, you know, let's reach out to her and see how we can help. You know, whether or not we were meant to be Wesley's parents or not, we wanted to be a support to her.
Well, Tricia, let's dig a little bit deeper here as far as some of the spiritual implications of what you and your family were going through. How did you see the hand of God, and how was faith such an important component of what you were experiencing during this time?
Oh, my. I mean, many people have asked us over the last year or so, you know, were we unsure? Were we, you know, unsettled about our decision? Was it a huge decision? And, you know, I can honestly say that for both my husband and I, we were just at peace with it. It now saying it and looking at it from maybe an outsider's perspective, it would seem like, oh, my heavens, you know, you guys, I can't even believe you would consider that. But when God is in the middle of something, and when he is working, and you are asking him to work in your life, you be prepared. you just don't know exactly the direction things are going to take. But we felt very, very at peace with the fact that we wanted her to come and be in our home. You know, we felt like that was going to be the best thing for him. We wanted to be able to give them some very happy memories together. And also, we wanted to get to know her, you know, as our family as well, so that, you know, as he grows and grows up into adulthood, that we also had wonderful memories with her that we can share with him.
Tricia Seaman here on The Intersection. You can find out more by going to her website. It's Tricia, T-R-I-C-I-A, Seaman, S-E-A-M-A-N.com. Well, The Intersection continues now with retired Air Force Colonel James Dutton, former space shuttle pilot, who discussed his own faith walk and his involvement as a member of the board of directors of the ministry Faith Comes by Hearing and its new initiative called the Global Bible Network, which is devoted to using technology to more effectively spread God's word. Here now from that conversation is James Dutton.
Global Bible Network is a distribution method for the audio Bible. And Faith Comes by Hearing really is about recording as many languages, all languages eventually, we hope, with the Bible, and then getting it out to every person on the planet. And so with technology just developing exponentially right now, they realized there were capabilities out there that could make it possible to reach people in ways we've never done before, and that's what Global Bible Network is going to do.
Well, and this is something that is still in the developmental stages, but when we talk about some of the new ways, the new technology that is available to make, well, the Bible available around the world, give us some examples of some of those technologies.
Sure. They've broken it out really into three major areas, although they're all interconnected. But, you know, the most exciting one and probably the one that got me involved was the celestial or the space piece of it, which is really about using space as the ultimate high ground to penetrate down into different parts of the world and over a frequency band, be able to transmit scripture, audio scripture and updates and so forth. Once it gets down, you know, to the planet, then there'll be a terrestrial system, which we have today, and we'll be able to harness a lot of what already exists, things like radio towers, potentially even fiber cable and so forth, to get those files out. And then there's a cyber piece to it, which is probably going to be the most challenging part. You'd think space would be, but a lot of the technology already exists in the space realm for us to take advantage of. But the cyber realm is extremely software intensive, and what they're doing is sort of creating an app that people would be able to have on their phones that would be essentially non-internet dependent, would be able to transmit through other mechanisms to get it out to people where the internet is not as prevalent, where it's not as easy to get on Wi-Fi.
Right.
And so when you take all those pieces together, the hope is that, you know, we'll be able to, as a language is recorded, it will be able to be released almost immediately and downloaded by people who speak that language. And that's one of the other exciting parts is language recognition software that as people speak into their phones, it would be able to recognize the language and then provide them an audio Bible in that language.
You've been involved in piloting the space shuttle, which is an incredible adventure. Talk about how you really took that career path and how your faith really intersected with that.
Well, you know, I came into the military not being a Christian, but I came in with the goal from the time I was in elementary school of going to NASA and becoming an astronaut. That was just the thing I latched onto as a kid and was excited about from a very early age. But I got into the military and God had other plans. He put me around just some incredible Christians who, you know, I would say that my faith had always been important to me, but I didn't really have a coherent understanding of what I believed. And so as I began to learn and was really ministered to by these people and in the scriptures, I became a believer. And so then it was an interesting process. As I continued to move towards NASA, God continued to show me that I needed to lay down that goal and give it to him, whether or not it was really of him. And yet he continued to give it back. And when it came to that final step of applying to NASA, I had gone through numerous other schools and training that I had to do to get to that point. I knew that, you know, the probability was very low, and actually did not even feel like the interview week went well. There were several indications that it hadn't. And I think God allowed that to happen to show me, because my prayer was, I only want to go there, Lord, if you want me there. And so when I did find out that I was selected, I knew it was him, because I was sure that it hadn't been me from the way that things had transpired. So the fact that we even got to fly in the shuttle, the class I was selected in 2004, we were told that we would probably not fly in the shuttle because of the backlog of unflown astronauts after the Columbia accident. But in the end, the shuttle program picked up, and they were able to fly all those folks, most of them multiple times. And so they elected to fly our class. And that was just a dream come true, because, of course, you know, from my childhood, the space shuttle was the vehicle, the poster I had on my wall, and the vehicle I dreamed of flying.
James Dutton here on The Intersection. Learn more about the ministry by going to faithcomesbyhearing.com. The Intersection continues now with Joey Lankford. He is featured in the documentary film called Living Hope. In our recent conversation, he shared a portion of his story as his family moved from Middle Tennessee to South Africa to minister to the people of Cape Town through the ministry called Living Hope. He was primarily involved with the provision of food for people. From that recent conversation, this is Joey Lankford.
We were actually on the ground working to really, really get the ministry of job creation and entrepreneurial development started in the townships, using food as a catalyst for that. And David called me literally one night and said, you know, I'm really hearing about your family and the story of how God really reached in and grabbed a hold of you. And obviously I'm familiar with Living Hope and the work of Pastor John and Avril Thomas. And we're thinking about doing a documentary. And I just wanted to see if you'd be open to sharing your story with us, if the Lord so leads in that way, once we're on the ground. And I said, sure, you know, I'm open to whatever the Lord's doing. And on little more than that, David and a crew came to South Africa some months later and began the work of putting together what is now the Living Hope documentary, which has been all over the country, seen in, you know, many, many churches and shown around the country. And really, you know, God has used David Kern and Epiphany Films and what they did and what he gave them as a vision for this project to really reach a lot of people and mobilize them into mission work of various kinds.
Well, tell me about your work. You mentioned earlier really learning about the use of these greenhouses in Cape Town, South Africa, as part of the overall ministry of Living Hope. So tell me about your role in the film and what, or how you and your family were depicted in it.
Sure. I think the family, what God did when David got there with his crew was really put together the story on our end, as far as my wife and I and our children, of, you know, it's a classic American story. My grandfather was a preacher. My uncles are preachers. My dad led the music in our church and started a healthcare company that I and my brothers took over. And really, you know, I think there's a lot of social, David and the film company saw a lot of social teeth to that story in where we sit as a country now. And so the family was basically what God did was, as they lived and immersed themselves in our lives for 6 or 8 weeks in Africa and got the backstory of what God and how God led us to the place to give up what we thought we were meant to do to find fulfillment in sacrifice, you know, and in living out Mark 8:35, giving away ourselves for the sake of the gospel and actually finding out who we are more and more as we walk the journey together. So the story is about a family, Middle Tennessee family that really had a line in the sand moment with the Lord. That he, you know, the Jeremiah 29:11, the plans and what we saw socially and what God was doing in our lives economically, but having all of that collide and really having to decide that we wanted God more than we wanted anything else. We wanted him to be real and powerful in our lives. We wanted to know the God we read about, and we wanted the abundance that he talked about in John 10. And so we set sail. literally, and went to Cape Town, South Africa, and really began to call out to him to move and work through our lives. And you know, I told you, we're still on the journey today. God always has a way in his crazy world of doing what we could never imagine, ask or imagine, Ephesians 3:20. And I say often that some stories only God can write. But if you'd asked me in 2010, it was all about giving up myself, going to South Africa, and really surrendering my life to God. But, you know, now we're in 2016, and we're talking about the Living Hope documentary and how that's blessed and motivated people to explore a deeper relationship with God, maybe missionally, maybe across in Africa, maybe next door. But what it's done for us is, as you mentioned, me going into food and food security and a job creation and economic empowerment through food and over a food platform. You know, what we always thought, you know, we were going to Africa for Africa, but as I mentioned to you earlier when you and I talked, I'm actually back in Nashville now using what Living Hope taught me to engage food deserts and under-resourced communities with food and skills training and letting that lead us to the conversations of Christ and who he is and how he answers all the questions, regardless of socioeconomic situations in our lives.
Joey Linkford, who's also the author of a book called Fulfilled. The website for the documentary is livinghopedocumentary.com. This is the Intersection Podcast. It's a weekly production of The Meeting House. Learn more at meetinghouseonline.info. There you'll find a link to the download center marked Meeting House On Demand, through which you can listen to, download, or share full conversations with recent guests that you hear on the Intersection Podcast. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast and have it delivered to your podcast receiving software, including iTunes, on a weekly basis. Two blogs are accessible. One is The Three, with three relevant stories to the Christian community. Also, there is The Front Room, with devotional thoughts and commentary from the Meeting House radio program. Plus, you can follow me on Twitter and access the Meeting House Facebook page. Video content is also accessible through the site meetinghouseonline.info. Continuing now with this edition of the Intersection Podcast, it's Alyssa Wilkinson. She is an assistant professor of English and humanities at the King's College in New York City and critic at large at Christianity Today. In our recent conversation, she discussed some of the elements that she and co-author Robert Joustra lay out in a book called How to Survive the Apocalypse, Zombies, Cylons, Faith, and Politics at the End of the World. From that conversation, this is Alyssa Wilkinson.
What we were trying to do was take a close look at a number of films and TV shows that are centered around the apocalypse in some manner, and think about them both in terms of the history of apocalyptic literature and in terms of what apocalyptic literature has always done, which is to provide a window into the reality behind behind what we think is really going on. So we, for instance, the book of Revelation is not merely or just about the end of the world, but it's also supposed to reveal some truths about the world that we live in right now. So we were trying to work in that vein and draw some conclusions about what that says about us.
Well, in light of what the author of Ecclesiastes says, that there is nothing new under the sun, you talk about the history of apocalyptic literature. There is quite a collection of apocalyptic movies and television programs, media to consume, but this really isn't anything new. It may be maybe more accessible now in these days, but certainly apocalyptic literature is nothing new.
No, that's right. I mean, basically, since the creation, we've been talking about the end, just about, and nearly every civilization has its own story of what will happen at the end of time, and that's always been true. We have a long chapter that I think is very fun to read that kind of talks about all the different sorts of apocalypse you see pop up in literature. What we did find, though, is you're totally right. So the one difference is that this is now part of our mass culture. It's how we entertain ourselves. And it's a huge business, right? So shows like Game of Thrones and The Walking Dead are among the most highly rated shows on TV. Movies like The Hunger Games series and the books, they rake in a ton of money. So obviously people are very excited to watch these stories of apocalypse and dystopia. And the big difference that we saw, and the one that really got me interested in the project, was the fact that in the past, we always talked about the apocalypse as something that God or the gods would bring upon us. And today, it's almost always something that the humans have we've brought on ourselves. So in Battlestar Galactica, we created Cylons and now they're chasing us to extinction. Or we create a virus and it turns out to cause the zombie apocalypse. Or we have oppressive governments or all kinds of things like that, technologies that we create that visit apocalypse upon us. So whereas in the past, we thought this was something that we'd be the victims of for whatever reason, now we seem to think that we're definitely going to bring it upon ourselves. And that's a big shift in apocalyptic literature.
Well, it's very intriguing when we think about humanity being its own worst enemy that would bring apocalyptic times to the Earth. What do you think that says about our own view of what it means to be human?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and this is part of the argument of our book is to see that all of our apocalyptic stories tell us what we think it is to be human. And in this case, it's a story born out of a time where we, you know, even those of us who believe in God and believe in a higher power of any kind, we tend to still think that we have a lot of agency in our own lives. And this is all part of, you know, many centuries worth of history, including things like the scientific revolution. But we think that, you know, we are the masters of our fate. We're going to create the bomb that's going to kill us all. You know, and this is all coming out of the horrors of the early 20th century. So that affects the way that we work with one another and how we think we should live with one another. But interestingly, if you actually look at our stories of apocalypse, we tend to think that we tend to have a turn towards something mysterious or something above us.
Alyssa Wilkinson here on The Intersection. You can find out more by visiting the website Alyssa, A-L-I-S-S-A, Wilkinson.com. The Intersection podcast continues now with Sean Lovejoy, directional leader for CourageToLead.com and author of a book called Be Mean About the Vision, Preserving and Protecting What Matters. In our conversation, he discussed the concept of vision and being committed to pursuing that vision as God leads. Here now from that conversation is Sean Lovejoy.
I have come to understand as a leader that there is a certain sense where every leader needs to be mean. And when I talk about being mean about the vision, I don't talk about being a mean person. I don't talk about being mean to people. I know some mean leaders. I know some mean people. I don't think I am one. I'm an extrovert. I love people. I love people well. I was a pastor, you know, for years before I became a coach of leaders. When we talk about the word mean, we usually have two different ways of using it. One, the most common way, to be rude, offensive, and the like. But when we talk, also when we talk about mean, we also use the word to imply intent. Well, what I meant to say was, or I meant that as a compliment. What you're saying is, I intended this to be that way. So when I talk about being mean about the vision, I'm talking about being intentional about the vision. Day in and day out, as a person, as a leader, as a family member, as a pastor, as a congregate, whatever it might be, to be intentional about the vision that you're pursuing in your life and your organization.
And it seems like to me there is a bit of a double meaning here, because when you're talking about being intentional, I think that there probably is an element of being, in a sense, relentless about pursuing what, of course, in the case of Christian leaders, what God has intended for you to do.
Sure, because I has an idea about what they think you ought to be and how they think you ought to act and respond in life. Everybody's got an agenda for your life. You don't realize it. That's why so many of us become people pleasers, because people inadvertently, so many times unconsciously, they try to bait us into acting and living a certain way. But it's not just at the individual level. This happens in corporations. It happens to CEOs. It happens to pastors. It happens to churches. And that's why most organizations start out with a vision and very few finish with one. It gets diluted. It gets derailed. It gets hijacked, whatever it might be, over time, because they're not intentional about staying the course over time.
Well, let's unpack the meaning of that word vision. When you're speaking to whether it be individual leaders or churches or whatever the case may be, when you're talking about a vision from your standpoint, as you lay it out in the book, what are we talking about here?
Well, most of us have at least heard, you know, the phrase thrown around, where there is no vision, the people perish.
Yep, yep.
But having been a pastor with a seminary degree, a master's degree in theology, you do your homework, you look at that. The more literal translation is where there's no revelation. So in other words, you know, if you're a God-fearing person, the word vision, you know, we believe vision is something revealed to us by our Creator. Rick Warren wrote one of the top-selling English-written books of all time, The Purpose-Driven Life. All of us want to discover why we're here, the purpose for which we were created. And then, of course, as leaders, how we're supposed to lead, what kind of organization are we supposed to lead, what are we supposed to pursue, what is the win? And I believe that's revealed to us by our Creator. It's something revealed by God. So it makes vision at a personal level, corporate level, very, very spiritual.
Well, you are listening to Meeting House here on Faith Radio. Sean Lovejoy is joining us today. He is with an organization called Courage to Lead. I wanted to take a little bit of a detour and ask you just about a bit about that organization. What is Courage to Lead? What does it do? What's it set up to accomplish?
Well, many of your leaders are probably familiar with the path of John Maxwell, New York Times bestselling yep. author. He was a pastor for years, began coaching leaders in his own congregation, his own community. And at some point, that coaching ministry literally became larger than the church. And God just used that to shape his vision for his life. And I know John, and my life's on a similar track. You know, we started doing the same thing. I was called to be a pastor, pastored people. But we began coaching leaders in our community, in our church. Also pastors around the country. And even though the church, you know, grew to be a mega church while I was there from four people in my living room, you know, over time, the coaching of leaders and the need for that became, you know, bigger than my own church. So about a year ago, I handed the baton over to my successor that I'd raised up within the church. The church is doing awesome, and began coaching leaders, you know, on a more national level through Courage to Lead, both in the corporate world and in the church. I was a good player, but I'm a better coach. And so that's what we do. We coach leaders. I think every leader needs a coach.
Sean Lovejoy here on The Intersection. Find out more by visiting the website CourageToLead.com. Finally, on this edition of The Intersection podcast, it's Travis Weber, director of the Center for Religious Liberty at the Family Research Council. In our recent conversation, he gave information about a recent case involving a Marine Corps Lance Corporal who was ordered to remove Bible verses from her workspace. A few days prior to the interview, Travis had observed a hearing on the case before a federal appeals court. From that conversation, this is Travis Weber.
The Lance Corporal had posted several verses of scripture at her workstation and was ordered by her superior to remove them and ultimately court-martialed because she would not take down the scriptures. Throughout this whole case, the military has really not been able to point to evidence of evidence backing its need and its claims that the removal of the verses was somehow necessary and required by some military need. This is an important fact, you know, because as we know, the military is, you know, different from civilian society in a number of ways. And the freedoms that we have in civilian society do not always carry over to the military, even when it comes to constitutional rights, though constitutional rights are not given up when people enter the military. So, you know, that's the initiation of the case. She was court-martialed. The court-martial was appealed up through the military justice system up to the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, which heard oral arguments in the case on Wednesday. And now we can expect a decision in the next few months.
So basically, this Marine Lance Corporal, her name is Monifa Sterling, she decided she wanted to post scripture verses at her workstation. She was ordered to remove the verses. Now, did she actually comply with that order?
Well, no, she didn't remove the verses. Okay. And, you know, she was ultimately court-martialed for that. You know, the crux of the case is whether, you know, she can be ordered to violate her religious freedom in that way. You know, we're going to permit, military commanders to order people to violate their religious exercise and allow them to court-martial them for disobedience of an order.
So she was court-martialed, and there was a military court that did not protect this practice, her freedom of religious expression. And something that came into play here is something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Apparently, the interpretation by this lower court was, well, I guess you might say, it involves selective application of the principles of RFRA. Talk about how that has factored in not only in the lower court decision, but also in what was before the Court of Appeals last week.
Yeah, the lower court applied RFRA in a very miserly way, basically saying that there's only a religious exercise when you have some formal established religious practice that's sort of been promulgated by a religious authority. Now, that's just not true under RFRA. RFRA, it's beyond clear that RFRA protects any practice or exercise of religion. Now, people may say, well, that permits anything. Well, no, it doesn't, because when someone brings a claim, they can show they have a sincere religious belief that's been substantially burdened. The government can still regulate that belief if it can show a compelling interest advanced through the least restrictive means. So, you know, the lower court, I don't know exactly why, but they just goofed up the RFRA analysis and applied it in a way that's just not faithful to the law. And, you know, we're hoping that that's reversed at the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces, where in the arguments it was made very clear the RFRA standard and that it was violated here. You know, and I want to emphasize again that this does not permit people to do anything in the name of religion, doesn't permit them to disrupt military order and discipline. I mean, the military has very specific needs when it comes to that, and those are compelling interests. It can advance through the least restrictive means in order to adhere to maintain its readiness to maintain order and discipline and to continue to operate as we need the military to operate. But what the law does not permit is the government to just arbitrarily, for no good reason, order religious exercise suppressed. And that's really what happened here. And if someone being told to remove a verse from their workstation when there was never any justifiable need of the military that was ever offered at any point. And that that's really the crux of the matter here.
Travis Weber here on The Intersection. Learn more by going to frc.org. Well, that just about wraps up this edition of the Intersection Podcast, the weekly production of The Meeting House. The website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Through that site, you can get connected to the Download Center. Also, you can subscribe to the Intersection Podcast and have it delivered to your podcast receiving software, including iTunes, on a weekly basis. Two blogs are accessible, and you can follow me on Twitter and access the Meeting House Facebook page. You can also get connected to video content. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Thanks for joining me for this edition of The Intersection. I'm Bob Crittenden.